ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, I'm Annabelle Crabb. Now, I wouldn't say I'm a hoarder exactly, but I do hang on to things. It's not just you and me. Australia's oldest library is crammed with stuff that isn't books. Terrible paintings, old menus, human hair. Is this history or hoarding? Come and have a rummage through the story of us told by our stuff. Search for the History or Hoarding podcast on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Late Night Live, coming to you from Gadigal land in Sydney. I'm David Marr. Profitable for some, the stoush with Iran is costing a lot of people and a lot of nations a huge amount of money. Later in the show, I'm asking financial seer Satyajit Das where the collision of big money and Trump's strategic ambition is taking the economy of the world. But first, the war is bad for business. Not all businesses, of course. Missile makers are raking it in. But Trump's Iran adventure is causing economic pain around the world. The stalemate on the Gulf of Hormuz is putting politics and economics on a collision course. How will this play out? That is the kind of mega question we love putting to Satyajit Das, once a banker, now a writer and global financial analyst. Das, welcome back once more to Late Night Live.
Thank you.
Around the world, I was shocked by these figures, around the world defence spending is on the rise. 2025, total global military spending, nearly $3 trillion US. What impact does this massive diversion of money have on the big economies of the world?
Well, I think you have to look at it, firstly, in a longitudinal sense. You're quite correct, it's up massively, but you have to go back to the early 1990s when the collapse of the Soviet Union allowed massive cuts to defense spending. And for instance, the US defense budget went from 6% of GDP to 3% of GDP. And Europe enjoyed similar benefits. So when you talk about the effects, the question is, where did that money that was saved go? And for instance, most of it went for private investment, social programs, particularly in Europe. And I think somebody once calculated that Europe's peace dividend was as much as 4 trillion euros, which is roughly about 6 trillion Australian dollars over 30 years. Now we're reversing that, and that means a substantial diversion of economic resources, and they're going from other things that we could have done to basically defense. And that's going to come about with unpopular reductions in existing spending or higher borrowing, which is difficult. But I'll give you an idea of the flavor of that. In Australia, as you know, the federal government implemented substantial changes to the NDIS scheme. But the most amusing thing about that discussion was nobody mentioned the AUKUS program, which is going to be a major cost. I think if you want to look for an anthem for this age, it actually is, of all places, from Black Sabbath. They used to have a song called War Pigs. Generals gathered in their masses, just like witches at black masses, evil minds that plot destruction, sorcerers of death's construction.
Das, you should have sung that. Now, look, I don't want to reproach you, but next time, if there's to be any song lyrics, I want the music in the background. But look, Trump has now had all of his tariff strategies ruled out of order by courts. What's he going to do now to try to maintain global dominance of financial markets? What's the next steps for him?
The first thing about tariffs is, yes, the Supreme Court has ruled the tariffs to be not legal, but it's only under one provision, which is basically as at a time of war. There are at least half a dozen other methods, and he's tried one of them, which has been ruled out. But he's going to keep trying this, and he's got a lot of time because he can basically keep doing this and keep going to the Supreme Court. And to be honest, the tariffs are only one part of economic warfare. There are a whole lot of other things that the US and its allies have been doing for the last 30 or 40 years, which is essentially weaponizing commerce, weaponizing the global payment system and the US dollars. And its foot soldiers are lawyers, legislators, and bureaucrats. And basically, they now use tariffs, they use these trade restrictions, there are investment controls, there are sanctions, there are exclusions from SWIFT, which is a major payment system, and sovereign asset seizures as well. And if I remember correctly, the Russian foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov, referred to the decision to confiscate hundreds of billions in foreign exchange reserves and investment that was Russia's property simply as theft, because it's clearly in violation of international law, including sovereign immunity and the inviolability of central bank assets. We've basically ignored all of that, and we focused on the kinetic side. But that's all been going on. And to be honest, it's not new. It goes back to medieval sieges. But there's a complete stream of economic warfare, which in part affected Iran, as we know, because Iran has been under sanctions for, God, as long as I can remember.
But what does Trump risk with this approach? I mean, there's got to be a downside for the United States following these sorts of strategies.
Well, it's actually quite interesting because the US seems to think it has a significant comparative advantage over everybody else. One of them is economic, but these financial things, they seem to be thinking that it's very powerful, and it probably in many ways outweighs even their military strategy. And there's now a lovely word around this. It's called choke points. Now, in my view, these are of doubtful efficacy, and there's some reasons for that. One, there's significant human costs. Lancet, the medical journal, did a study, and they found that since 1970, 30 million people's deaths can be traced to these types of financial or economic warfare. And most of them were actually children and civilians, and certainly a lot of women, a lot of old people. And that was mainly through basically impaired access to food and medicine. So that's the first problem. The second is, I don't think this signals actually economic strength. It actually signals terrible economic weakness on the part of the US and its allies. Deindustrialization and financialization have hollowed out Western economies, so they're completely uncompetitive with rising powers like China. So this is just a last-ditch attempt to preserve their economic and military primacy. And the main reason I think it's risky is they risk military confrontation. People forget that sanctions on Japan before the Second World War were a key factor in the country's decision to attack the United States. And the Iran war is not dissimilar. And more to the point, the Iran war is illustrating that what the US can do, others can do just as well.
And what's Iran been doing back at the US?
Well, I think the Iranians have developed a brilliant strategy. It's got two legs to it. One is military. Now, there's no way Iran can match US and Israel militarily on the battlefield. So they've used asymmetric military tactics, which is basically using their very sophisticated missile and drone capabilities to retaliate. Now, the strategy has some interesting sidebars to it. So essentially what they're doing is using extremely cheap drones and missiles, which they can mass produce. And these are being countered by very high-tech expensive systems on the side of the US and its allies. Now, to give you an idea of the disparity, to shoot down a 50,000 drone, you need interceptors which are worth millions. And Tehran can also produce much more of these than the US can produce. I saw an interesting comparison done by some military analysts. Tehran can produce roughly 100 ballistic missiles a month. The United States can only manufacture 6 interceptors in that same period. So it's actually got an economic element, this. It's not only asymmetric militarily, it's asymmetric economically. So you have these massive costs now. The Pentagon reckons the cost of the war is $29 billion. I've seen estimates which saying it's cost about $70 billion through till the end of April, I think it was. I think it's costing around about $1 to $2 billion a day, give or take. And to give you some perspective longer term, the Iraq war cost the United States $2 trillion when you factor all the costs in. This one, some estimators are saying is 1 trillion. And I think it was Stalin who said this, wasn't it? That quantity has a quality of its own.
But there is more to that, more to this than just money.
Absolutely. And this is the major issue, which is the closure of the Straits of Hormuz and the attacks on the GCC, the Gulf Cooperation Council's energy production facilities. And that's taken out roughly 12% of global oil supplies and probably 20% of gas supplies. And the thing is that even without doing very much, the moment you threaten things like the Straits of Hormuz, what happens is shipping insurance prices go up, owners are concerned about the safety of the vessels and crews, and so they're basically not willing to risk very expensive ships going through crucial waterways until the hostilities have ended. There's an amusing sidebar to that as well, which is the US and President Trump trumpeted that the US would insure these ships. And I looked it up just before we went on air to see if any ships have been insured.
Yeah.
And the answer is zero. Not a single ship has been insured under that scheme. And so essentially, what we're seeing is the economic part of this asymmetric strategy as well. And the effect is quite major. It's the largest in history. It's greater than the 79 Iranian Revolution, the oil embargoes of the 1970s, the invasion by Saddam Hussein of Kuwait, and also the Iran-Iraq war, right, which was in the 80s. And the funniest thing about this is, if war can ever be funny, is that the US and Israel did not appear to recognize the risk. But the funniest element of not recognizing the risk, which, by the way, they're now saying they knew all along, but that the Islamic Republic publicly stated what they would do, and over and over before the war commenced. So why this is a surprise to both the US and Israel and its allies and the world befuddles me.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and I'm talking to Satyajit Das, global financial analyst. Trump claims that he was about to strike again, a massive strike the other day, but he's held off after pressure from the Gulf states. Now, what is the economic role of the Gulf states in this? What's their leverage?
Well, I think you have to come back a stage. The first thing is, I'm not sure that statement that Trump held off because of the Gulf states requesting him to is correct, because there are now allegations that the Gulf states, A, didn't know about the attack, and B, they haven't actually spoken to Trump. And as we know, President Trump lives in a world with imaginary friends, which he's talking to constantly and negotiating with. So I don't know whether it's true or not. So that's the first thing. But yes, the Gulf economies have some leverage. And that leverage comes about because of their massive investments in the West. The Gulf economies are massive exporters of fossil fuels, which gives them a huge amount of income. Now, that income that comes in, relative to the size of their populations, is disproportionate. So what they've historically done since the first oil shocks is use those dollars to invest overseas, which is mainly in Europe and North America, North America being the major recipient of those funds. And those funds flow into a couple of areas. One is obviously in buying government bonds issued by the US Treasury, and also into shares, and increasingly over the last few years has gone into what we call private markets, which is investments in things like AI done through private funds.
Yeah.
So there's a massive amount of money that they've actually got invested, which actually means they're enormously conflicted because that money is at risk. And now what they've got is an expected contraction in their economies because they obviously can't export as much oil as they used to. And so they have to find funds from somewhere. There's several ways they can do that. One is they could sell these investments. Now, the Gulf countries were in a process anyway of redirecting their investments, because what they're trying to do is redirect their funds into their domestic economies for a post-fossil fuel future. And so what actually was going on now has been accelerated, and almost all of those sovereign wealth funds, which are the major investors through this mechanism, are now questioning where they're going to put their money. Now, that's the economic sidebar. But there is another element to this, which is very important, because I suspect the Gulf countries are reassessing their strategic relationship to the US. And this is where they're caught between Iran and the West, because their financial interests say, well, we should protect our investments and align with the West. But that would create a major problem for them. Because if you look at these Gulf countries, the ordinary person in that actually does not look at the West with any great favor, nor for that matter do they look at their monarchies with great favor. So this risks the monarchies threatening their own survival longer term. But if they actually side with Iran, then they essentially lose their so-called security cover, which is of dubious value in my view anyway. But also that means they become vulnerable to regime change actions by the US, Israel, and its allies. So they're now caught in the middle. And there's also a very funny thing that went on, which is United Arab Emirates asked for what's known as a swap line. Now, to make it very simple, a swap line would mean the US would make dollars available to them, which they're very short of, in return for them giving them dinars, and affected the dinars rather. And what would happen then is over some length of time, these would be reversed. But there's a supreme irony here, which is the UAE probably has an investment portfolio of $2 trillion, a lot of which is in the United States. They're now trying to borrow money. And the reason was very simple. If these sovereign wealth funds and these nations start to sell US assets, then the price of the dollar would go down and the price of these assets would go down. And so despite protestations to the contrary, clearly America was very concerned about that. And they're trying to use this currency swap lines to prevent the sales of these investments. So that's where they have some leverage. Now, how important that leverage is and how much power that gives them remains untested.
So what's the pressure going to be on Australia?
Well, if I look at Australia, Australia's in an interesting place, is how I would describe it. The first thing that you're going to see is obviously that until this war is resolved, there's massive uncertainty. So it was quite funny to see the budget being presented a couple of weeks ago, because I was scratching my head thinking, is how the hell do you forecast anything under these circumstances? Because you don't know what's going to happen. So that's the first problem. We don't know. The second thing is there's a couple of things which are very clear, which is inflation is going to go up. And it's not only oil, because oils ain't oils, if you know what I mean.
Yes.
You know, people think of oil as being something you put into your car, but the process from crude to the different products we use is a very lengthy one. So there's shortage across the board. And just before I talk about Australia, there's something which is very important, which is the prices you're seeing, like, you know, $100 a barrel is meaningless. Because essentially, that's not what's the issue here. That's actually paper oil prices. That's what we call futures contracts or derivative contracts. The real oil price is probably 50 to 100% over that. So when the Minister for Energy, Chris Bowen, was saying we've bought oil, that wasn't being bought at $100. That was being bought somewhere between $150 and $200 a barrel. Jet fuel is about $170 a barrel last night. So the price is much higher, and we haven't seen the full flow through of those prices into inflation yet, because people have inventories and the people have stock. As that runs down, we're going to find these prices start to actually be fully reflective of those inflationary pressures. And that automatically means we'll see the Reserve Bank look at interest rates and say, do we need to push these up further to restrain inflation? But that'll slow the economy. And that's going to be the major problem. And we're seeing growth forecasts around the world slashed. And if you think Australia is bad, you just have to look at places like Southeast Asia, which are very important to us because they're important trading partners. Street vendors who make very modest living are now going out of business because the price of cooking gas or the plastic containers has gone through the roof. Our mining industry will be whacked by the fact there's a massive shortage of things like sulfur, which is used to make sulfuric acid, which is essential to industrial processes. So all of this will flow into higher inflation, higher interest rates, and a slowing economy. But Australia also benefits. One of the benefits is a perverse one. Higher inflation means that people's incomes will obviously be pushed up to some degree, and that'll push them into higher brackets of taxation, which will give more income to the government. The government will gain from higher commodity prices, and they'll also get some income. So there'll be certain benefits, but the most important thing here is twofold. Australia has been at the forefront of financialization, hollowing out its industrial base, and becoming completely reliant on long supply chains. We've outsourced everything, including our local oil refining capabilities on cost grounds. So we are extremely exposed to disruption. And the second thing is, it makes us extremely vulnerable to people that we trade with, China being a good example. So we had the rather unseemly sight of our politicians going around Asia, literally begging for supplies of diesel and also jet fuel. And obviously there's a quid pro quo for that because we give them minerals as well. But the interesting thing is there seems to be no coordinated strategy, because I was reading that some Chinese companies which have investments in Australia in rare earths companies may be asked to divest those. Now, it doesn't make sense.
By whom?
By the Australian government.
Yeah.
And so under those circumstances, it does seems to me on the one side, we take out our begging bowls and asking for jet fuel and diesel. On the other side, we're saying, well, your money isn't welcome here. So there's a huge series of contradictions that Australia has lived with, which is our defense and cultural ties to the United States and our economic dependencies. And this is going to bring that out in very sharp focus.
Das, explain something for me. If a war is causing inflation, why don't we just wait for the war to end rather than punish the economy in the meantime?
Well, firstly, you're assuming that this will end soon.
Yes, I'm an optimist.
Well, you're in the what we call the TACO group. And the TACO group means that Trump always chickens out.
Yeah.
And the opposing group is the Nachos, which is not a chance Hormuz opens. So I think while those two things can be joked about, the reality is the world has changed. And it's changed in the way that I don't think Iran is going to give up control of the Straits of Hormuz. And I think basically, even if we go back to something like the status quo, there's going to be higher costs. And don't forget, war creates massive damage. All the damage that's been done, damage has to be restored. And that takes months. And I don't know. And I was speaking to somebody at one of the oil service companies. I said, how long do you think it'd take? He says, well, we've got to go and have a look first. And he says, we're not sending anybody out to a war zone to go and inspect what needs to be done. So basically, it's a long process. And I'll give you an analogy, because we didn't talk, when we're talking about the Straits of Hormuz, of the Bab el-Mandeb, which is the gateway to the Red Sea. And that's sort of open, but in the last round of fighting between the Houthis and the West, they closed it. And that was 2 years ago. And even today, the amount of traffic that's going through there is about 75%, because people are rerouting ships around the Cape of Good Hope, or they're doing it from some other source. And under those circumstances, those costs will go up. So yes, we can wait. But the problem is, you're assuming that all of this will be over in a short period of time. I think there are two things that are very important. The world's morality and humanity died somewhere in Gaza, and the economic structures that we've grown up with died in Iran. It's going to be a new world. And what that looks like, I have no idea. But it's not going to be the one that we live with.
But Das, isn't there perversely a cause for optimism in the general rule of United States politics, which is that in the end, money gets what it wants? And while, as I pointed out in my introduction, there are industries, businesses in the United States that are having a ball while this war continues, as you've been explaining, the general effect on the economy is going to be dire. Isn't that going to mean that money will muster its strength and put an end to this?
It goes to a more fundamental point. The US is quite isolated from some of the rest of the world effects because it's a net energy exporter. And in fact, US energy companies are benefiting massively from the actual shortage of oil because they get the higher prices. Now that flows through into obviously consumer prices and inflation and all the problems that it causes. But essentially, if you look at the US, it's also less of a trading country than almost anywhere else. Only about 13% of their GDP is exposed to trade. In Australia's case, it's like 50, 60%. So they're relatively isolated. And while the ordinary person is being hammered in the US as it is everywhere else, the people who matter aren't as affected. They're getting richer. And they're so absorbed with high technology and the AI boom. At the moment, they believe that they are going to be actually isolated and be able to ride this out better. Europe doesn't think that. Asia doesn't think that. Africa doesn't think that. Latin America doesn't think that. But they do. So yes, there is a change in the actual environment which should affect them, but it'll take a long time to do that. And it's actually interesting to look at US politics through that lens. If you look at the amount of money you need to win just nomination to run for your party, Senate, something like $120 million was spent in Kentucky on just the primaries. And that money doesn't come from you and me. It comes from large donors. People talk about Russian oligarchies. US is no different. And it's what those oligarchs think that'll matter in the end.
Das, thanks for joining us again on Late Night Live.
It's my pleasure.
I've been talking to Satyajit Das, global financial analyst. This is Late Night Live. Coming up, a Palestinian coming out. Tarek Bokoni was born into a Palestinian Christian refugee family in Jordan. He's now a Londoner and an expert on Hamas. But all the time, as a kid, a student, an academic, he's been gay. And the collisions of all those identities is the subject of his beautiful memoir, Fire in Every Direction. Tarek has come over the road from Sydney Writers' Festival to join me in the studio. Tarek, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, look, I want to clear something up right from the start.
Okay.
You know Sydney well, don't you?
Relatively well. I haven't been here in 23 years.
Yes, but explain why you were here 23 years ago.
So I did a year abroad. I was studying for my undergrad in London, and I did my third year as a year abroad student at the University of Sydney.
And you lived, I understand, from the book, in a college on the campus of the University
That's
of Sydney.
That's right, St. Andrews College.
I was going to say you were shy of naming the college, but you name it now, St. Andrews?
St. Andrews College, yes.
Yes.
That's where I was.
Did you enjoy time in college? It must have seemed rather old-fashioned and odd.
Well, I did enjoy my time a lot. As I wrote in the book, I mean, it was a formative year for me because that's when I really grappled with my sexuality and decided to come out. And I love being in Australia. I think it's a beautiful country. I traveled a lot throughout the country the year that I was here. And, I haven't been back to Sydney since then. So 23 years have passed. And a couple of days ago, I just went walking around the university and the college. And it was nice to see how it's
changed. A
couple
of nights ago, did you
say? Yeah.
But it's wonderful that we can point to St. Andrews College, Sydney University, as the place that finally convinced you that you're gay, to come out,
right.
To have lovers.
You wouldn't expect that from St. Andrews, would you?
Not necessarily, no. But let me tell you, it's an old, old story.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely.
Old stories. Your family had shifted and shifted with every with every phase of violence in the Middle East since the Second World War, hadn't it? Mm-hmm. Your grandmother fled Haifa in 1948?
Yeah, all four of my grandparents fled Haifa in 1948, yes.
How old was your grandmother then?
She was about 20 when she fled.
Right. Yeah. And they fled where?
So they fled by boat to Lebanon, so up north on the Mediterranean to Lebanon. And for a few years after the Nakba, after the dispossession in 48, the Lebanese government used to naturalize Christian refugees rather than Muslim refugees because they were playing with the demographics of the country.
So the Muslims went into the camps. The right. Christians went into the cities.
Went into the cities. They were given citizenship, and so they were able to get flats and go to school and get educated, get jobs.
But the decision came, this time your mother's decision and your father's decision, to leave Lebanon. Why?
So in 1978, Lebanon was well on its way into a civil war. I mean, the civil war really started in 1975. And my mother at the time was very active in student politics, really, but she was engaged in the struggle for Palestine in various ways. And it was increasingly dangerous for them to stay in Lebanon as the country was in the grip of violence. And so they decided to flee to Jordan.
Why Jordan?
For several reasons, actually. I mean, I think my mother's uncle was already in Jordan when that part of the family was dispossessed from Palestine in 48. They had landed immediately in Jordan. And there was a big Palestinian community in Jordan already. Many of them had been naturalized. And so they had connections through just the Palestinian diaspora, and it felt like
they wouldn't
the right
be arriving as absolute strangers.
No, no.
But you write that being a Palestinian refugee in Jordan came with some understandings. What were those understandings?
Well, a lot of the refugees in Jordan were actually not granted citizenship, unlike them, because we had arrived already as naturalized Lebanese citizens, and then we land in Jordan as citizens, not necessarily as refugees, albeit citizens of another state. The understanding was very much that you don't talk politics. You know, Jordan is a very conservative place. It's a monarchy, and there's no room for activism. There's no room for politics. And so the understanding, especially this is the understanding after Black September, when the Jordanian government had cracked down on the PLO and the Palestinian Revolution in Jordan, the understanding was that you don't touch politics.
This must have been hell for your mother.
Yes, I mean, for several reasons. The politics, on the one hand, obviously she had been an activist, in many ways a revolutionary, being told that she can't be active on Palestine anymore. But also romantically, you know, my mother had been dating my father, and Lebanon is a very open, very progressive, at the time, quite a cosmopolitan place. And that relationship was in many ways expansive. And then she lands in Jordan and she's told by her uncle, you know, if you stay here, you're going to have to get married. You can't just be in a relationship that's not defined legally. And so she goes from being a student and an activist to being a housewife who's not active on politics in a very short period of time.
Penetrating silence seems to be one of the major reasons you wrote this book, because I get a sense that you actually knew very little about your family by the time you began investigating. Very little. Silence extended to being silent about the record of your own family.
Absolutely. I mean, I think growing up in Jordan, and many, many people, you know, the majority of the Jordan's population are of Palestinian descent. And yet there's a lot of silence in terms of how we learn about Palestine, how we learn about our history. Even in school books, we don't get a lot of information about the history of the Palestinian struggle for all the reasons that I just mentioned. It's a very precarious situation for the Jordanian government. And so the especially Amman tends to be a very conservative, very small knit community. And so there are silences, obviously silences around politics and Palestine, but also silences around social issues. For me, the silence around queerness and being
well,
gay.
Exactly. You had a good deal to be silent about as you were growing up.
Yes. And I think in many ways, this book was, when I'm asked, I often say that I'm writing against the silence, that I'm all the things that we couldn't really talk about, I wanted to document somehow. I couldn't talk about that then, but I can talk about it now. And I wanted to have a place where I'm able to narrate what I wish could have been narrated to me in my childhood.
There's a wonderful image in the book of a set of steps that connect the classrooms in your school to the playground, with a blue railing, and you perched there on those steps, described by yourself as an ugly kid with thick glasses.
Yes.
Being mocked, ridiculed by fellow schoolboys. How did that resolve itself?
Well, it didn't. My experience of being in that school was actually one of fear. You know, I was bullied, as you say, I was ridiculed. And I always knew that I didn't quite belong in that space. I tried, as many, you know, gay boys would tell you, one of our first experiences of our sexual orientation is to try to belong, quote unquote, to be normal. Mm. So there was definitely an effort to try to be like all the other boys in the schoolyard, and that failed miserably. And so there was a lot of bullying, there was a lot of ostracization. And I guess part of it didn't resolve itself, but part of the reason I found my place was because I met a schoolboy who was in my class called Ramzi, who became a dear friend and in many ways a protector in the schoolyard. He was very popular, very sporty, you know, doing all the things that young boys were meant to do.
And he befriended you.
And he befriended me for reasons that I still can't understand.
And you worried at times that he was kind of sending you up by befriending.
Right. I didn't really trust our friendship at the beginning. I didn't quite know why he would turn to me, you know, this popular kid who's friends with all the other boys and wanted by all the other girls and sporty and wonderful, becomes a very close friend, and he's my neighbor as well. So we end up spending a disproportionate amount of time together in school and outside of school. And really, he becomes a member of my family. He's to me closer in many ways than both of my brothers.
You loved him.
And I fell in love with him.
Of course.
Mm-hmm.
But you knew he was straight.
Mm-hmm.
And he knew you were gay.
Well, I don't know. That's is that how it read to you in the book?
Yes, there's that letter he wrote to you saying, "Look, even if you're gay,
right,
I'll still love you."
Yes.
And when you did, the inevitable of sort of embrace him sexually or try, he still was willing to be your friend, but you were not willing to be his friend.
Right. So just
now, explain that. To me, perfectly straightforward, but to others, probably very baffling.
Right.
Explain.
Well, so this is someone that I love dearly, I fell in love with, and I, you know, wanted more than anything to be accepted by him and to be honest to him about who I am and about my feelings to him. And just to put things in context, we would often write to each other. So this is how a lot of this communication would happen, by letters.
Because you kept the letters.
So I kept his side of the letters. I obviously don't have any of the letters I sent to him, but I have a stack of all of the letters that he sent to me over the course of a decade. And this stack is really my way into the book. So I reconstruct that childhood relationship, which is more than two decades old now, through the letters that I have from him. You know, against every reaction I get from him, I try to reimagine and reconstruct what I might have said to him. And so I reconstruct that history. And yes, so I inevitably, as you say, at some point, I tell him that I have feelings for him. And I'm imagining this boy who's much worldlier than I am, who knows, you know, the ways of life, to tell me, you know, how to deal with this challenge that I had thought myself to be facing. And, you know, I'm not going to spoil the book, but a whole series of things happen which make any kind of conversation between me and him quite difficult. And parents get involved, and it becomes a situation where I feel a great degree of shame, and I feel a huge amount of judgment, and I feel like there's just no way for us to maintain a friendship anymore, because everything's been, you know, this careful balance of trying to be friends without saying the unsayable becomes open and exposed, and there's just a lot of shame and self-loathing, I think.
How old were you at this point?
16.
Yeah. On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and I'm talking to Tarek Bakoni, who is the author of this beautiful memoir, Fire in Every Direction. Tarek, what matters most for gay men in the Middle East? Being Muslim, being Christian, being Arab?
I mean, I don't know. I don't think it's one of those things. I think that we all have very complex identities. I identify as a queer man who's also Christian, who's also Arab. And I don't hold these identities in conflict anymore. I did at some point. I thought that these were things that were irreconcilable. But I think we all have several layers of complex identities. So I think they're all in us.
But growing up and being overwhelmed as you were as a young man by shame, what's the source of that shame? Is it Christianity? Is it being Arab? Is it being sort of refugee?
No, I think every person has their particular experience. For me, I grew up quite a devout Christian. My grandmother, who was a formative figure in my life, was a Christian. My entire family are Christian, but she was very much a believer, a woman of faith, and I was raised in many ways to be a believer. And I think that was the biggest source of my shame, that actually what I was doing and who I was becoming was sinful. And so I spent a lot of my childhood years praying for forgiveness, praying for absolution. So in many ways, it wasn't necessarily being Arab or I wouldn't have identified as an Arab. You know, I was in a relatively homogenous society. Everyone around me was the same. But I think it was what I had learned at church that was primarily the source of shame and sense of guilt.
Still a Christian?
No, I walked away from my faith around that time. When I was coming out, I realized that there were fundamental issues I couldn't reconcile with Christianity.
That's a familiar pattern.
Yes.
Yes. Tariq, what do you think of the boast of Israel that it's a particularly friendly country to gay men?
Well, I think that's a lie. I mean, I think it's a friendly country to specific gay men or specific members of the LGBTQ+ community who are Jewish. I think regardless of how Israel tries to position itself as this sort of civilized nation that's progressive, that supports queer rights, ultimately it's an apartheid regime that's carrying out a genocide. So, you know, whether you're queer or not, if you're Palestinian, you're dealing with a military occupation. And if you're in Gaza, you're dealing with genocide. Your sexuality is irrelevant. What matters is that you're Palestinian, therefore you must be killed. So this idea that Israel is, you know, a beacon for gay rights, it's just propaganda.
Another exile in your life, this time to London.
Yes.
What was it like to be in London at that time? Gay, but not facing the fact.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is actually where the whole identity of being Arab comes up. And I land in London thinking, oh, my home, everyone in Jordan, they can't accept who I am. They're backwards. I have to leave into the civilized city, London, where it's cosmopolitan, where everyone has queer rights. You know, I buy into liberalism, essentially. And it takes a minute to understand that, oh, this liberalism works only in a certain direction. If you're an Arab man in London, you're facing other forms of racism and discrimination. And all of that comes crashing to me in 2003. So this is when the Iraq war starts and the UK, obviously with the US, start their illegal invasion of Iraq. And suddenly I understand that for all of the ways in which I can feel like I've, you know, been accepted in this city, actually, I'm still living in a Western reality that continues to be colonial and that continues to carry out imperial invasions. And that's not really where I belong.
And is that what propelled you into the study?
Yes.
Tell us about that, sort of changing direction academically.
Yeah, so by that stage, I'm an engineer. I'm studying engineering. You know, like a good Arab boy, you have the options of going to engineering, law, or medicine, and I chose engineering, the least of all possible evils.
a good Jewish boy, yes, a good English boy, the same choice.
The same choice, you know, if you're South Asian as well. It's all of these sort of immigrant communities in many ways. But I was studying to be an engineer. And I trace, you know, a lot of people actually, and I've thought about this a lot. I don't know why for many people of my generation, 2001 was a formative experience, you know, the September 11 attacks. For me, they weren't. I for some reason, they didn't have as much of an impact on me, maybe because I was in the UK, not in the US. But for me, 2003 was very formative. And I realized that I didn't understand, you know, why was the UK invading Iraq? And what was the context around all of that? You know, I'm a young 20, 21 year old, and I'm trying to understand the politics around all of that. And that becomes then the source of some kind of obsession for me to understand Middle East politics and the history of the Palestinian people.
And so you studied essentially, I mean, what is the path to you becoming an expert on Hamas?
So I continue my studies in engineering. I graduate, I start working in engineering, but then on the side, I take some time out to finish a degree in international relations at Cambridge, and then continue into a PhD that I'm doing part-time. So I'm working full-time, I'm an engineer. I continue to work for the better part of a decade while I'm finishing the PhD part-time. And the PhD is the entry point into Hamas. So this is around 2006. Hamas is running in Palestinian elections and is winning unexpectedly. And I'm living in this world where everything in the West is sort of demonizing this movement as nothing but a terrorist organization. And Palestinians are voting for this movement. And that dissonance is my entry point into Hamas, to understand who Hamas is, what they are on their own terms, outside or beyond the narratives of the English-speaking world.
Who are they?
They're a resistance movement. I think they're a nationalist resistance movement. They are a movement who are fighting for the liberation of Palestine. And they, in many ways, they're the continuation of historic Palestinian politics of the PLO before them. The only difference is that they couch their ideology of Palestinian nationalism and resistance in an Islamic garb. So they, you know, they call for the full liberation of Palestine from the river to the sea because it's waqf, because it's a sort of an Islamic endowment that has to be held in perpetuity. The PLO before Hamas said exactly the same thing. We must liberate Palestine from the river to the sea, but that was secular nationalism. So it's a continuation of decades-old Palestinian politics, but couched in Islamist terms.
And what about their violent tactics?
I mean, all anti-colonial movements have had acts of violence, including Fatah, which is now embodied in the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank. And Hamas did as well. And Hamas continues, obviously, to have engaged in violent forms of resistance, as well as popular and peaceful forms of resistance. But regardless of the nuances around its tactics, whether it's popular, peaceful, or violent, in the West, it's sort of given sort of this wide brushstroke of being a terrorist organization, which really prevents any kind of actual engagement with Hamas and deflects from the real and in many ways, multiple times more violence that Israel carries out against Palestinians.
London has an effect on many people who go there with this wonderful sense of, you know, London will be beautiful, London will be different, that's where I'll bloom, etc., etc. London has a way of teaching people that they belong where they were born.
Hmm.
But you've stayed in London.
Hmm.
How's that been?
Listen, London is an incredible city. I feel very lucky to live there. In many ways, I feel like it's home. I have a community there. I'm very established there in terms of my writing, in terms of my life. I feel grounded there. At the same time, it's not really home. It's, home is I don't know where home is. In some ways, it's in Jordan. In some ways, it's in Lebanon. In some ways, it's in Palestine. But I think this is actually an experience that many people in exile identify with, and many queer people identify with, which is that home is really the community you have and the people you love and the family that you create. Wherever that may be. And for me, that's in London at the moment.
You went back and found your grandmother's house.
I did.
But you didn't knock on the door. Now, tell me about that.
So growing up with a Jordanian passport, I wasn't allowed into Palestine because the Israeli authorities prevent the majority of Jordanian males between the ages of 18 and 45 from traveling to Palestine. And so I had to naturalize in the UK as a British citizen. And the first trip I took was to Palestine.
And that was the first time in your life?
In my life, yes. And
yeah.
And I was obviously doing field work for my PhD, but also on a personal mission of finding my grandmother's house. And I only had descriptions of how to get to the house that were communicated to me verbally. She had no maps. She had no street names.
First left, second right.
First left, second right, after the hospital. And thankfully, the area that she had been dispossessed from remains relatively, I mean, obviously the Hebrew names and the street names have all changed, but the area in terms of its topography has remained relatively clear. And so I managed to find the house, incredibly. And you know, I just, many Palestinians, it's a very subjective experience. This is a common story for Palestinians to find their family homes and homes they have, their family members have been dispossessed from. Some people knock, some people go in, some people fight with the owners. I stood outside and there's no way for me to know. It could be a Palestinian family living there, you know, with Israeli citizenship. It could be an Israeli family. It could be an American Jewish family, a French Jewish family, who knows? But I sort of felt like I actually didn't want to find out. I wanted to see the house and I wanted to imagine that the house was empty and waiting for my grandmother's return, and now she's passed, then my return one day. And I didn't want to engage in a conversation where someone would say, oh, but this isn't your house anymore, because, I mean, their opinion is irrelevant. I know what's right and I know that this is our house.
Do you imagine yourself returning there one day?
I don't know. I imagine everything I work towards is to free Palestine and to get the right of return for Palestinians. So I definitely want the option of going back, because that's what justice is, to recognize that there was an act of ethnic cleansing here and that a free Palestine is the only way that we can imagine justice and peace. And I would certainly love to go back and be in Palestine and have the ability to live there, yes. But who knows? I mean, I think that's an impossible question.
But it's a pretty fundamental question, isn't it?
Absolutely. Well, it's
if generations of refugee Palestinians are still wanting to return, then nothing's been resolved.
Oh, nothing's been resolved. In terms of the right of return, that's not a debatable question. For me, the right of return is for me irrefutable. I will fight to my death for the right of every Palestinian refugee to go back to their home. So that's not in question. The question is whether once that right is secured and Palestine is free, will I go back and live in my grandmother's house? I don't know. I mean, I think that will depend on whatever reconciliation process happens. But is it my right to demand that I go there? And is that my house? That's irrefutable in my mind.
Ramzi, has he read the book?
I have no idea. You know, we haven't been in touch since...
Surely you must want to know.
You're dangerous. I have a curiosity, but I don't know if he's read the book. And I will not reach out. You know, he's become a figment of my imagination. You know, we haven't spoken in 25 years. I don't really know who Ramzi is today. I don't know. I have a sense of where he lives. You know, I know that he's in a certain city and I know that he's, you know, doing a certain job. But yes. Because Amman is small and everyone knows everyone. But he's a stranger to me. I know nothing about him.
I'm laughing on this side. Yeah. I know nothing about this man.
Well,
you write so intimately and beautifully.
Well,
about.
But about yes. About a boy that I knew 25 years ago. I don't know who he is as a man. I don't know who he is as a man he is today. I mean, he's a stranger to me today.
He's read the book.
Do you think?
Of course he has. Would you not read a book if you heard on the grapevine that somebody had written a book about you?
Yes,
as a
maybe.
Child? Of course you would.
Maybe.
Amongst the many thousands who've read your book,
well.
Tarek, and the many thousands I would recommend to read it. Thank you so much for joining us on
Late
Night Live.
Thank you for having me. Thank you. It's a pleasure.
I've been talking to Tarek Bokoni, author of this beautiful memoir, Fire in Every Direction. Tarek is everywhere at the Sydney Writers' Festival this weekend. You'll be hearing a lot more about and from this man. Thank you. It's the end of the week, so chatterbox time. Talking to Josh Glancy last week about that British sub, back from 206 days continuously underwater, the subject of sex on board came up. How? I don't know, but it did. Josh had no answer. Helen has helpfully sent a page from Chuck Polonek's book, Stranger Than Fiction, True Stories, where Chuck writes about being on the mess deck of a sub with a bunch of sailors who were talking amongst themselves about the perils of having women on board. Women on board would lead to pregnancies. Chuck writes, I'd been on board long enough to see how cramped their life was. No way, I said, could two people find the room and the privacy to have sex on board. And another sailor crossed his arms over his chest, leant back in his chair and said, oh, it happens. Loud and clear, he smirked and said, it happens a lot. Every man in the room was glaring at him. What followed was the longest moment of angry silence in Navy history. Thanks for clearing that up, Helen. As always, my thanks to the marvellous Late Night Live team. To Catherine Zengerer, Anne Arnold, Ali Benton, and our boss, Jack Schmidt. Until next week.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.